You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Kazuhaga of the East Point Peace Academy about his work inside and outside California's schools and prisons, working with nonviolence and transformation. We'll also speak about how his insights into restorative justice and kicking in nonviolence can help turn around our understanding of police brutality into constructive action for accountability and deep systemic change.
At the end of the day, we understand that people are never the enemy. It is injustice that is the enemy. And so how do we build movements that really attack the forces of injustice and hold individuals accountable with compassion so that we can move closer to reconciliation? And I think it's that understanding of nonviolence that changed my perspective forever and has been kind of grounding me in since.
Before you with her hands on her hips, she said, I'll accept nothing but loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be love, love, love.
Way. Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguano, Wuligiskut, welcome and greetings in my native language. It's a beautiful day here. I'm coming to you from my home in the Dawnland in Bunawapskek territory in and along the shores of the beautiful and majestic Penobscot River in central Maine. And as always, I'm joined by my illuminous and radiant co-host, Miss Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Hi, Sherry. It's also a beautiful and glorious day out here in Taos, New Mexico, where the summer breezes are sweeping down the mesa. Today, we have a rather sobering but hopeful subject matter at hand in light of recent events throughout our country, which have been coming fast and furious. We thought we'd reach out to Kazuhaga, who is arguably, and I don't think I need to argue about this, he is one of the most remarkable people that I've run across, working in the field of nonviolence, restorative justice, change, and transformation. He's the founder and coordinator of the East Point Peace Academy, which I encourage you all to look up online because it should really set your mind spinning about the possibilities in the world, and Kazu will talk about that a little bit today. He's a Kingian nonviolence trainer based in Oakland, California, and works with youth, incarcerated populations, and activists in this realm. He's also on the board of Communities United for Restorative Youth Justice. As you can see, he's a perfect guest for Love and Revolution Radio, and he also has some really eye-opening and insightful and often challenging perspectives to share about what's going on across our country and in the world. Welcome, Kazu. And Sherry, why don't you lead us in with the first question?
Thank you, Rivera. Kazu, it's so nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Like so many of us that do this work in social justice and peace activism, your work expands across a diverse network of projects and engagements. And it would be wonderful if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what a day in the life looks like for you. What are some of the things that you're engaged in, and how does that work touch and impact your life?
The organization that I started, the East Point Peace Academy, it's a play on words of the military academy at West Point. And we work with an understanding that if people who are in institutions that use violence, such as the military or law enforcement, they have to commit themselves to a pretty rigorous level of training in order to learn how to use violence effectively. And we feel like the same thing goes for peace and nonviolence, that these aren't things that you can take a four-hour workshop and understand overnight. But nonviolence is really like a form of martial art, and that you need to train yourself and to practice consistently in order to become effective at the uses of it. And so our goal And our work is about institutionalizing nonviolence. And, you know, oftentimes in our work for social justice, we talk about how systems of violence and racism and patriarchy and all of these things have been institutionalized and embedded within the institutions throughout our society. And so our goal is to institutionalize its antidote and to work with institutions, high schools, universities, prisons, county jails, law enforcement agencies, and embed the practices of nonviolence and conflict reconciliation into these institutions so that it becomes a part of the day-to-day operations of what these institutions do. And so right now, the majority of our work is in the prison and county jails throughout California, where we work with men and women inside to empower them to become the leaders for movement for peace and a movement for change from both within the prison system as well as in their neighborhoods.
Great. Will you tell us a little bit about the work that you do with youth as well? Because I know that's one of your other major programs that you engage with. What does that look like and how do you connect with them? Is it through the school departments, through the, we have friends who work with youth via the Juvenile Justice Department. What shape and form does that take with the East Point Peace Academy?
Yeah, it's mostly either with schools or with youth organizations. Our most successful work, and this actually predates the starting of the East Point Peace Academy when I was working with different organizations. But there's a high school in Chicago where we started doing some work in 2009. And this one school, the North Lawndale College Prep High School, really embedded the practices of nonviolence. And in 2009, they started their campaign. They lowered their rate of violence by 70% in the first year of the program. And they've maintained that all the way up to a 90% reduction in violence. And so that's kind of the model that we're trying to replicate in schools in the Bay Area. Again, if it's possible to institutionalize violence, then it's possible to institutionalize nonviolence, the antidote. And so we're trying to find the right school partners who can really take this on as a serious commitment, because things like restorative justice and nonviolence and conflict reconciliation, it can't just be one after school club. It really needs to be embedded within the entire institution. So, you know, oftentimes it's a very slow process, starting with the working partnering with maybe one classroom, one teacher, but ultimately our goal is to spread throughout the entire institution so that it can become something that's as important as math and science.
I think that kind of holistic approach is incredibly important when you're dealing with these types of things, like you said, that the other behaviors are so systemic. They're so deeply embedded. We're dealing with more than 17 centuries of war mentality and war philosophy and this separationist kind of ideology that we've all been steeped in. And one of the things that I've talked to one of the other guests about, because I do some restorative justice work myself, is looking at how the prison for profits system actually de-incentivizes the prosecutorial system from being able to look at diversionary programs and alternative justice programs, that it actually becomes an obstacle to it because in its very nature, it encourages incarceration. Have you had any experience with that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's definitely some industries where I feel like there should never be a profit motive. Prisons definitely being one of them, education, healthcare, so on, the military. In California, we technically don't have private prisons. But that can be very deceiving. There was a man that I worked with in county jail who, when he got sent to prison, he was sent to a reception at San Quentin State Penitentiary. And then the next time I heard from him, I received a letter from him in Mississippi. In the letter, he said that he was being held in San Quentin, and then one morning they woke him up and shipped him and thousands of other men to a private prison in Mississippi. And so while we don't have private prisons, the state of California, CDCR, does contract with private prisons in other states. And I think it's also important to realize that even if you're not being held in a private prison, even in the state systems and in the county systems, the commissary, the meals, the phone calls, all of these are oftentimes contracted to private corporations. So even within public institutions like state prisons and county jails, there's private interest there. And it definitely does make our work more challenging to reduce the prison population because there is an incentive to lock more people up.
Will you tell us a little bit more about the nature of the work that you're doing in the prisons on the East Point Peace Academy website? It talks about two programs, Peace from Within and Sitting in the River. But I know myself, I would love to know more about what the programs are, how they work, and what the effects on the people who engage with them are, and just how does that ripple out? I do have a friend who also works in prisons, and he talks a little bit about his experiences of what happens when people are going on parole and bring these skills back into their communities. And I'm wondering if you would just like to share a little bit about how the work takes place and what the effect is.
Sure. So we work with kind of a grounding philosophy and an ideology that the people who are most impacted by any issue has to be at the leadership of a movement to change that. And so when we're looking at issues of violence in our community, there's no one who's been more directly impacted by systemic violence than the men and women and the people in our criminal justice system. So our work is really about empowering them and utilizing their experience, their wisdom, their expertise to create change. And so our biggest project is about empowering men and women and people inside to become nonviolence trainers so that they can then educate their peers in nonviolence and to try to change that culture within the prison system. And we also have been bringing people from the outside into the system to learn about nonviolence from them. And we're trying to work with the system and work with some youth groups and some schools to be able to bring in high school students and young people into the system to learn about nonviolence from these people inside. And that's why the program inside is called Peace from Within, both in terms of peace from like cultivating peace from within each individual, but also cultivating peace from within some of the most violent institutions in the country, because we know that a lot of the violence in our communities is dictated by some of the cultures that exist within the prison system. So we're trying to change that culture. And then Sitting in the River is a weekly meditation group that we have. Right now, it's just in one county jail. We're hoping to partner with different organizations to be able to spread that. But it's just a weekly mindfulness sitting group. And we're starting to open that more and more up to people from the community to come join us every Friday, because we found that the more people we can bring in from the outside, the more it breaks down those walls and those barriers. And the men inside have commented that, you know, as more and more people come from the outside just to sit with them every week, it normalizes the experience so that our group Sitting in the River, it's less about a program for incarcerated men as much as it's just a community of spiritual practice. And I think it's important that they have spaces where they can remind themselves that they're not just inmates, but they're also just humans and members of our community.
That's such an important piece. And some of the trainings that I do, one of the things that I talk about is humanizing the other. And one of the things that we've really failed to do, I mean, we have to also humanize ourselves oftentimes in our own eyes, especially when we've been engaged in behaviors that have been damaging to ourselves and to others in the past. We have to rehumanize ourselves in our own eyes, and that spiritual practice is a large part of that process. But I also think it's really important to remember that these systems and these structures that have been built out of our pain, that have been built out of this long-standing patriarchal structure of just war and of segregation of so many groups of people, that those systems and structures are all supported by individuals who come to work every day. And we understand that there's a problem with the system, in that people operating within that system oftentimes lose sight of who they are as individuals, and they fail to bring that with them into the workplace because the system has been structured for so long to meet a certain norm that no longer serves humanity, that may have never served humanity. And the importance of being able to bring ourselves into those processes and having the courage to be able to challenge the status quo, to have the courage to be able to speak truth to the lies of that system is vital to our being able to change things in a way that truly institutionalizes nonviolence practice, that truly institutionalizes a more humane way of being with one another in the world. And so I think that's vitally important. Have you recognized or witnessed any changes that have come about as a result of people engaging in that transformative process that work within those systems and people that are even incarcerated within those systems?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first story that comes to mind as I was hearing you talk is we did a two-day nonviolence workshop a couple years ago in a county jail. And after the workshop was over and all the men had been locked back up into their cells, the guard who was on duty during the workshop came up to me and he kind of whispered in my ear, "Is like, hey, man, can I get a copy of that training manual that you were looking at? Because I was really paying attention to what you were saying and I think I can use some of this stuff." And so, you know, that's just one story of one individual. But I do believe that there's transformation happening even from the people who are just kind of on the sidelines watching us do our work. As an organization, we operate with a 250-year work plan because we know that this kind of change is generational change, right? It took us many, many generations to get to this heightened level of violence, and it's going to take a long time to get out of it. And so on the one hand, I think we really need to celebrate these small changes where one person can perhaps have a new perspective on things. And at the same time, we need to be building powerful movements that hold these institutions accountable and really looking at making radical fundamental changes. But yeah, I mean, I'm very privileged doing this work because I get to go into, you know, what many would consider the belly of the beast in these prisons and county jails almost on a daily level and see positive transformation happening every day. And so to be able to see that kind of transformation on a daily level is a real privilege for me.
One of the things I learn a lot from you is watching the humility with which you go about doing this work and the sense of curiosity and learning that you always bring to it. You always seem to incorporate that into it and the sense of deep listening. One of the things that I think people often do, including myself, is we come in with our preconceived notions of what is nonviolence, how do we talk about it, how does it work. And I always learn from you to remember to open the conversation and listen to what's expressed from the people that I'm speaking with, that not all of us see or discuss or talk about or use the same language around nonviolence or the word peace. And that it really can shift quite dramatically from one community towards another. And that we have all this discussion in the field of nonviolence, quote unquote, about this word nonviolence. And one of the beautiful things that I see in it is that everyone uses a different word. There's a word. There's lots of people who actually want to use just one word and they're always searching for the perfect word. But I actually appreciate that we have so many different descriptions for this work that we share together and different ways of expressing it. I'm wondering if you'd care to comment on how you came to this approach and what are some of the things you've discovered through it?
Yeah, there's a Zen teaching that says that words are fingers pointing at the moon. They're not the moon itself. And I love that quote because I think a lot of times we get into conflicts over different meanings or different interpretations of the same word. And words at the end of the day are just sounds that we make with our vocal cords. And it's the meaning and the intent that we put into it that gives that word its spirit. And so I think it is both a beautiful thing that we have so many words to describe this work, but also can create conflict, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. The particular type of nonviolence that our work is grounded in is called Kingian nonviolence conflict reconciliation. And it grew out of the teachings of Dr. Martin Luther King. And I came into it in 2008, I believe. I had already been involved in social change work since I was about 17 years old. And I've been in and out of work that I kind of identified as nonviolence. I was actually used to do nonviolence trainings when I lived in Massachusetts many years ago, but I stopped doing it after a couple of years because I felt like there was something missing in the work that I was doing. And then fast forward about 10 years in 2008, I was working for Harry Belafonte, a civil rights legend and icon. And as part of that organization, I took a two-day workshop in this philosophy called Kingian Nonviolence, and it completely blew me away. And I saw this particular curriculum as everything that was missing in the stuff that I was doing before. I realized that the stuff that I was doing before, I was doing nonviolent civil disobedience trainings and nonviolent direct action trainings. And that's obviously a key component within the world of nonviolence. But I realized through taking the Kingian nonviolence training that nonviolence wasn't just a strategy and a tactic. When we talk about things like nonviolent direct action, we're using the word nonviolence as an adjective in the sense that we're using direct action that is not violent. And I always argue that if we see nonviolence simply as an adjective, as something that is not violent, then the KKK can use nonviolence to push forward their agenda. And I think if we're grounding ourselves in the principles of nonviolence, what makes that different is that it's not just about not being violent, but it's about taking a proactive stance against violence and moving towards this idea of beloved community and reconciliation. I think the idea that we're trying to bring all conflict to a place that can be reconciled is what makes nonviolent movements different than other philosophies for social change. That at the end of the day, we understand that people are never the enemy. It is injustice that is the enemy. And so how do we build movements that really attack the forces of injustice and hold individuals accountable with compassion so that we can move closer to reconciliation? And I think it's that understanding of nonviolence that changed my perspective forever and has been kind of grounding me in since.
Kazuo, I think that's a really important point because we've seen in the news recently that the KKK has committed to engaging in nonviolent activity going forward. And so this isn't just a hypothetical. This is actually something that's happening. And so we can't look at hatred and division as being nonviolent. It's more than just an action. It's actually a way of thinking and a way of being in the world. Like you said, developing the beloved community. And one of the things that I think is really important in what you said is that we have to recognize the impacts on all of the people that are participating in this. And we have to remind people of their humanity. We have to remind people of their connectedness to one another. One of the things that we tend to do is to isolate and exclude people who have broken the rules rather than reminding them of all the times that they have not broken the rules. Reminding them of what it feels like to be part of a beloved community, to be included. And I think that's a real key piece to the work that we're doing going forward. I want to go back to something that you said earlier where you talked about the people on the sidelines, when you talked about the guard who came up to you after the workshop and said, I think I can benefit from this. It's really important to talk about the people on the sidelines because in the work that we do in racial justice work, in looking at all of these social justice issues, is we tend to look at it in a very cut and dry way. We look at the victim and the perpetrator. We look at the oppressed and the oppressor. And one of the things that we fail to recognize is that every single one of us has been impacted in a very deep way. I just wrote an article about this the other day for Native News, where looking at our ability to be able to sit with our pain, but also to recognize the pain of others, that not only is it the oppressed and the oppressor, the victim and the perpetrator, but everyone that witnesses that event is impacted for it, that there's a reverberation that actually vibrates into our being, just being in the presence of any type of violence, and that we carry the energetic impact of that in our bodies and we pass it on to future generations. This has been now proven by science, but it's something that people who have been subjected to generations of trauma are well aware of, that we carry not only the trauma of our current experience, but we carry the trauma of those who have come before us. And I would love to hear from you about this because the article that you wrote, Policing Isn't Working, actually looks at some of that, looks at how everybody's impacted by this, that you can't escape the impacts of violence, even if you're simply a witness. And I think that that's a really important point to understand because when people say, well, that doesn't have anything to do with me, yet they're watching these videos of incredibly violent attacks against citizens. They're watching the fallout of the shooting of these police officers in Dallas. They're watching the actions of terrorists in other countries, that that actually does impact them. It does have something to do with them. And I think that that's a piece that we need to shorten the distance of and help people to recognize how that impacts them.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a lot to what you just said, a lot of things that I want to say too in response. So in our workshops, we get a lot of people who ask the question of, well, isn't violence just part of human nature? And I used to almost believe that, but about a year ago, I heard a man by the name of Paul Chappelle speak at a conference where I was also at. And he was saying that every scientific study that has ever been conducted on violence shows that violence is traumatic, like you were saying. And that even, as you were saying, even just witnessing violence and being surrounded by it can cause PTSD, stress, anxiety, depression. And this guy, Paul Chappelle, went on to say that no human being has ever been traumatized by an act of love. And he says that if violence is part of our human nature, then shouldn't we be able to engage in it without it causing all of this permanent damage in our brain? And he says that that to him is evidence that violence is not part of our human nature, that it's things that fulfill our potential as human beings that is part of our nature, and we just need to get back to that. And so I think when you think of stuff like that, you definitely see. I was actually in the county jails last Thursday, right after all this news about Alton Sterling and Philando Castile and that was coming out. And as we were doing the check-in with the men in our group, it was just like something was in the air. Every guy that was checking in was saying, oh, I'm depressed today, I'm pissed off today, something's not right with me today. And I think that heightened level of tension and violence is something that we all do feed off of. And like you said, it gets passed on from generation to generation. But I think a lot of the work that we do is also reminding us that if we have intergenerational trauma, then it must also be true that we have intergenerational wisdom, and that those things can spread too, and that those things can be passed down from generation to generation also. And so I think a lot of the work that we do is about reminding ourselves of that wisdom, reminding ourselves of our truest human nature, and knowing that that will spread just as much as violence will. And I think I'd love to read that article that you mentioned that you just wrote. You also just mentioned that I wrote an article on waging nonviolence about policing. And just acknowledging that we know that being surrounded by violence is traumatic, and we know that it scars our souls. And so we need to expand that understanding into police officers also, and acknowledge that the violence that they're forced to not just witness, but to engage in and participate in is destroying their soul. And so if we really want to change that system and that institution of violence, then we need to understand that it's impacting people on all sides in a negative way, right? And that we need to hold individuals accountable with compassion and systems accountable with indignation, and really work hard to change those systems, because it's not serving anybody. You know, I wasn't around during the Vietnam War era, but one thing that it seems like has really shifted is that now we understand that supporting veterans means ending war, and acknowledging that veterans are just pawns in a much larger system of violence. And I think we need to do a better job expanding that that analysis to police departments also.
Kazu, there's so much truth in what you just said, and I just want to follow up with a couple of things before I turn it back over to Rivera. When we talk about, from my cultural perspective as an Indigenous woman, a Skijinawiapid, what we talk about with Indigenous wisdom is about that very thing. It's about having that genetic memory of the wisdom of our ancestors. It's about having the ability to survive and to thrive. And also, when you talked about the impacts of taking a life, I mean, when we do that, we are violating life itself. We are violating the very thing that gives us existence here. It's completely contrary to our nature. And Paul and I have had a number of pretty intense discussions about that. He's a very good friend of mine, and we've done a number of trainings together. And I think that when we talk about these issues, we often talk about the problems and the challenges, but we also have to talk about the beauty that's held within what we carry within us, the beauty of being life-perpetuating beings, the beauty of having this inherent wisdom that comes from this long history of life that we come out of. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and really highlight the importance of taking the time to recognize the really beautiful, the really positive, and the really powerful things that we carry within us as life-perpetuating beings. So thank you for bringing that up.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and this special tribute song from Diane Patterson. This music is called The Shape of Your Sorrow, and it was written in a poignant tribute to the victims of the Orlando Pulse shooting. We offer it to you this week as a moment of mourning, not just for the victims of the Pulse shooting, but also for all the people who have lost their lives recently to violence both here in the U.S. and around the world.
What is the shape of your sorrow? What is the shape of your sorrow? Scars that heal with time and scars that don't heal. Scars that go away and scars that stay. What is the shape of your sorrow? What is the shape of your sorrow? Shots rang out in Orlando. Where were you when the queens and kings of Pulse died on the dance floor? Where were you? Was your hand on the trigger too? Because you had separated your hatred from your fear.
Was Diane Patterson's song, Shape of Your Sorrow. You can find it on SoundCloud under Diane Patterson. And you can also find her CDs and other music at www.dianepatterson.org. And now, let's return to speaking with Kazu Haga. When Kazu just mentioned that concept of intergenerational wisdom as well as intergenerational trauma being carried forward, it's just like a light bulb went off in my head. I'd never actually considered that, so thank you. I want to go back a little bit to this article that you wrote, Kazu, Why Policing Isn't Working for the Cops Either. It's a really powerful article because while refusing to let anyone off the hook for violence, holding everyone who uses violence accountable for that choice, you also were really attempting to shed some light on what's on the other side of the picture that maybe we're not seeing, or maybe only one side of this conflict around the police is seeing, which, as someone who has definitely been in support of Black Lives Matter, who's been really following the reports of police brutality. I've been really trying to do my homework and learn what's on the receiving end of the police brutality spectrum, what it's really like for people of color in this country, which is a really stark and painful experience. But I haven't actually done my homework as much on the other end and tried to understand what's happening on the police department side of the picture. I've accepted certain narratives as generalizations that apply in all cases. But there's a few things that you brought up that I think are really worthy of highlighting for our listeners. And so I was wondering if you'd speak a little bit more about something you mentioned on the show about the system, about how we want to hold the system accountable and not just go after the so-called bad apples of the police department, but to recognize how this police system is creating untenable situations in our communities that cause death, harm, injury, injustice, and over-incarceration, over-policing, racism, all these things. And if in the course of explaining a little bit more about that to our listeners, you could mention a little bit about the story of Casebolt, the guy at the pool party who threw the young Black woman to the ground by the hair. I felt like learning about that story was a very eye-opening example of how we don't necessarily really have a full picture of what's going on.
Sure. So one of the principles in Kingian nonviolence is attack forces of evil, not persons doing evil. And when we talk about holding systems accountable, I want to just preface it by saying that we're not talking about not holding individuals accountable, right? Individuals and systems play a role in perpetuating these systems of violence, but they play a different role. And so they, I think individuals and systems require a different process of accountability. And when we talk about holding individuals accountable, I firmly do not believe that punishment and incarceration equates to accountability. I think accountability isn't actually, I don't think you can force accountability on somebody. I think accountability is something that has to come from the individual. And I think part of it is that that individual first needs to have and feel and sit with genuine remorse for the harm that they committed. And I think because our society is so quick to move to punitive forms of justice and retribution, I think when you try to punish someone, it's hard for them to sit with the remorse of what they just did because you're putting them in a situation where they have to be defensive. And if they're being defensive, they're not really sitting with the impact of the harm that they just committed. And so I think when it comes to holding individuals accountable, we have to first honor their story so that they can get beyond their own pain and defensiveness and understand the harm that they caused. And at the same time, in terms of systems, I started doing a lot of police accountability work in 2009 after the shooting of Oscar Grant in Oakland, which happened just a mile from my house. And I kept thinking at the time that the officer that shot Oscar Grant, his name was Johannes Messerly, I kept thinking that if it weren't Johannes Messerly, it would have been some other cop. Right. And we've seen after Oscar Grant just incident after incident after incidents of police killing. And we know that this is not a story of just an individual rotten apple, that there's something wrong with the barrel itself. And so I think the more that we're focusing our anger on individuals, the more we're letting the system off the hook. And so I think it's really important that we understand, you know, where the problem lies. And Eric Casebolt is a great example of that. Most people remember the story of that pool party in Texas. And it turns out that that was the third incident that the officer who dragged that girl to the ground and pulled out his gun and aimed it at a bunch of teenagers, that was the third call that he, the third incident that he was called to that day. And the first incident was a suicide case where he watched a man blow his head off in front of his family, and then he had to console this man's family. And right after that, he was called to another suicide case where he had to talk a young girl from off of a ledge. She was trying to kill herself in front of her family. And so he said that by the time he got to the pool party, he was just emotionally not present, and it was just an emotional wreck. And while that, again, doesn't justify what he did, I wrote in that article that Casebolt should be fired immediately. and that he should never be allowed to work as a police officer or a security guard or in any position of authority again. And at the same time, it becomes very clear to me that this is a system that didn't care enough about Eric Casebolt's own mental health that they couldn't even give him the day off after he watched someone blow their brains out. And just putting ourselves into the shoes of someone who has to constantly witness things like that, I can understand why someone would snap and do something that they might not normally do. And so I think it's important that we hold the system accountable for putting human beings into situations where they're constantly witnessing violence and forcing them to engage in acts of violence and not taking care of them as human beings after they've been scarred in that way.
This brings up an interesting point of discussion for us. There are those who would argue that it is the individuals who make up the institutions, as we talked about earlier, but I think that it's really an important point to focus on, and I'm going to try to articulate my thinking around it clearly. First of all, there is no point of accountability for a lot of individuals within a lot of systems. But as you said, there's also no point to allow for humane reconciliation for what's required of them in whatever particular job that they have. And to me, this corresponds to something as a Native woman that I've seen in my own community and in other Native communities and in other communities where there are people that have been really marginalized and oppressed in really violent and domineering ways, is this tendency to protect our own from the other. And when we protect our own from the other, when we associate ourselves with a group mentality, this ethnocentrism, whether it's along racial or religious lines or group affiliation, whatever it may be, that there is a space in there for denying that accountability. And I think that that's something that we have to deal with within our own communities. That's something that we have to be willing to deal with within our own families. That's part of the evolution of our consciousness, you know, going from egocentrism to ethnocentrism in regard to group alignment and starting to transcend and then reintegrate back into this idea that if we fail to hold people personally accountable, if we fail to provide space for people to heal, if we fail to allow people to sit with the pain of what they've done, we're going to continue to have these outcomes. And I don't think it's an either or thing. I think it's an and both, that we have to really look at how are we perpetuating this thing that's systemic within our own communities, within our own families, the helicopter parents who never allow their child to take responsibility for anything. If the child is in some kind of conflict, it means that there's, you know, someone else to blame. This blame shifting to the outside, this protecting of our own from the other, that there's something in there that we have to reconcile ourselves before we can reconcile it within the systems that we're engaged in. And I would love to hear what your thoughts are on that, because it's a really complex issue. I mean, we could spend a whole day talking about this one thing and how this all plays out within the systems that we're engaged with, as well as in our individual lives.
I oftentimes say in my workshops that nonviolence isn't a switch that you turn on when you go to a protest and then you turn it off when you're back home with your family or you're in the meeting organizing the protest. And that I think a lot of movements that see themselves as nonviolent internally within the movement were perpetuating these systems of violence. And so I think if we're really committing to building a nonviolent society, then we really do need to look at ourselves. And I think so much of accountability is about self-accountability and learning to hold ourselves accountable for the ways in which we recreate these systems within our own communities. You know, like you said, I think so much of understanding the world, we have to move towards an and/or perspective of seeing things. I think on the one hand, it's great to have pride in your heritage and in your community and who you come from, and have that sort of affinity is a beautiful thing. And I think there is dangers in that also. And, you know, I live in Oakland in the San Francisco Bay Area, And there's a lot of affinity spaces. So I go to a people of color meditation group, and there's Asian-only spaces, there's queer-only spaces. And I think those spaces are so important for people to be able to see themselves reflected, to see or to be fully accepted for who they are, not have to worry about anything. And at the same time, I have seen that being in those spaces too much, it almost like we become too comfortable, and we become uncomfortable when anyone outside of that identity is in our space. And that's not the purpose of these spaces, right? The purpose of these spaces is to cultivate strength and resilience so that we can really truly be ourselves in the larger world. And so I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of the fact that even these quote unquote exclusive or self-selective spaces is a stepping stone towards beloved communities, a stepping stone towards being able to see everyone as part of our family. And I think sometimes we do lose sight of that.
I think there's an interesting dimension to this conversation as well, which is the parallel to circles of cops and police, that they also have an affinity group. They also have inner circles that either hold themselves accountable for their actions or not. And we've seen actually a number of cops now come forward and speak out about the internal culture of their police departments that is they find perturbing, that they find to have quite a bit of racism in many cases, or also an ethic around silence and not holding each other accountable. And I think within that picture, one thing that's coming to mind now is that there's an opportunity for transforming to holding each other accountable through making that a value that they hold as police. But I think one thing that might actually help in that regards is this conversation about punitive versus restorative justice. And we often are very afraid to take on accountability for our actions when we fear the punishment that might come from that kind of honesty and accountability. So I think there's a dynamic in all of this together. And it relates to something you wrote in your article, Kazu, about that the police are trained almost exclusively in violence. I'm almost quoting from the article here. And then they're sent into conflicts or fields of conflict with these limited tools. And I really appreciated that framing of what's going on in our police departments, because as a nonviolence trainer, as someone who works actually in conflict, all of nonviolent action is about navigating conflict, I very much appreciate and understand that most of our populace, including our police departments, including our military, are fairly unaware of the broad range of tools that those of us who work in the field of nonviolence or nonviolent conflict resolution or unarmed peacekeeping have become exposed to and equipped with for dealing with conflicts in ways that are not violent. And so I was wondering if you would share a little bit with our listeners about why is violence a limited tool for the police in the situations they're dealing with, and what is the more expansive set of tools that our police could be exposed to and trained in for the work that they do?
I think when I talk about police being trained in tools of violence, there's two levels to that. One is the psychological side, right? Even as a person who works in the county jails and the state prisons, when I first started going into these institutions, you have to take a volunteer orientation training. And a big part of that training is these administrators telling you, don't trust these people. They will try to cheat you. Don't do them any favors. A lot of them will lie to you and they'll try to steal from you. And so they're trying to train me and ingrain this mentality of fear and division in me. And that's just, you know, a 3-hour training. So I can only imagine what a 6-month boot camp to become a police officer or whatever it is, what kind of internal violence and fear and division and separation that you're trained in. I had a friend who used to be a probation officer who says that she used to come home from her training in tears every night because they would just try to ingrain this mentality of the young people that she's going to be working with might try to hurt you, and that you have to do whatever you need to do to get home that night. And that's the mentality that our law enforcement officers graduate their police academy with. So I think that's part, that's a big part of it, right? Is the emotional and mental violence that they're trained in. But also in terms of how they actually handle conflicts, you know, if you've ever been quote unquote on the wrong side of the law, you know that a lot of police officers, it seems like they go out of their way to escalate conflict. They will yell at you and scream at you and call you names and wave their weapons. And as nonviolence trainers, we know those things escalate conflict. And so we're arming these people, these human beings, with tools that have a really high likelihood of there being unintended consequences and backlash. And we're sending them into situations of conflict and telling them to take control of that situation. And then somehow we act surprised when they use violence. And I think one of my vision is that things like nonviolence, undoing oppression workshops, those types of things become institutionalized and mandated as part of every police academy. You know, I have a friend who was also a nonviolence trainer, came home one night and there was a fight going on outside of her house, and she's an amazing musician. And so the first thing she did was she ran inside and grabbed her guitar and started playing a song like right in the faces of the people who were fighting. And the two people who were fighting was just so confused that they turned around and walked away. And she was able to break up the fight with her voice by singing. And I think, you know, just imagine what it would be like if police officers were trained in nonviolence and they could have the creativity and the humanity to try to deal with these incidents of conflict without resorting to violence. I think there's a lot of opportunities to de-escalate conflicts. People do it all the time, all throughout the world, every day. But unfortunately, we're not arming the professionals whose job it is to go into conflicts with these tools of de-escalation.
One of the things that is troubling to me is this court case that allowed for the police to recruit individuals with lower intellect, I guess. It's a terrible delineation, but that they're specifically choosing people who may not have the capacity to rise to this level of negotiation. And so when you have a system that is self-fulfilling in a way, that is self-perpetuating, because it's actually encouraging the recruitment and the employment of individuals who may not have the capacity or may not have the skill set required to be able to manage conflict effectively. It's not in everybody's wheelhouse. There is a need for people to guide that process. And so if we're going to have peace officers, which, you know, originally is what the police were referred to, if we're going to truly have them step into that role, then we have to have people in place that are capable of actually engaging that process in a way that helps others to rise to it. And I think that everybody's capable of rising to it, but not everybody's capable of guiding that process in a way that is savvy enough to bring everybody to the table. And so we need to also look at what is being done and really address these systems where there is a purposeful perpetuation of that escalation type behavior. There is a purposeful perpetuation of maintaining these systems and histories and structures of violence that is actually being solidified by the way that people are building upon these structures. I mean, how do we as a populace demand that change? How do we ensure that individuals who are capable of actually coming into a space and providing the opportunity for people to de-escalate violence? It can be done creatively across the board. There are a number of ways to do it. But when you talk about trained professionals, the professionals that we're dealing with aren't trained for that purpose. How do we change that? How do we change all of these underlying factors, have a real honest discussion about it, and begin to shift the trajectory that we're on, be able to halt the perpetuation of these types of things in a real and meaningful way? Do you have any suggestions?
I do think that anybody can be trained in effectively using nonviolent tactics. I really do believe that, and that's the majority of the work that we do is going into institutions where people have never even considered using nonviolence and training them to become the leaders. And at the same time, in Germany, the prison guards are attorneys and social workers and therapists, and those are the prison guards, never mind the program staff and all that. And so I think one of the things that we need to do is to build powerful movements like Black Lives Matter to demand accountability. And part of that has to be to really review the training practices that go into police academies. Because I think, you know, like we always say, and like we were saying at the beginning of this conversation, violence has been institutionalized. Right, it gets institutionalized starting with the police academies because that's people's entries into this institution. And so I think we need to embed the antidote and to really look at how do we institutionalize practices of nonviolence and peace within these violent institutions. And I think it's very doable. We just need to mobilize and demand that.
And that's much of the work that you have stated that you want to be doing with the East Point Peace Academy. I want to remind our listeners just at this moment in our last minute of the show that we are speaking with Kazuhaga, who is the founder and coordinator for the East Point Peace Academy. He's a Kenyan nonviolence trainer based in Oakland, California, and on the board of Communities United for Restorative Youth Justice. Kazu, would you just leave our listeners with one last concept to ponder as we head out of today's show? And perhaps how they can get a hold of you if they're interested in getting trainings or supporting the work that you're doing or going further with some of this conversation we've been having today.
Yeah, people can find me on eastpointpeace.org. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/eastpointpeace. And hopefully folks can actually come and join one of our trainings that we do someday in Oakland, or we're also willing to travel anywhere to do this work and to build with people. You know, I think I want to go back to this idea of reconciliation. You know, a lot of times in our workshops, people ask the question of self-defense and where is the self-defense line within the world of nonviolence. And I always say that, you know, self-defense can be very effective in keeping you alive, and I think there's great value in that. And I don't think it's the role of people advocating nonviolence to criticize or have judgments on people who feel like they have no alternative to keep themselves safe. But one thing that violence can never do is create reconciliation. And one thing violence can never do is build relationships and build beloved community. And I think at some point, if we're going to create a world with justice for all people, we need to start moving towards reconciliation and start moving towards beloved community. And violence is something that can never get us closer in that direction. And so I think, as we talked about before, I think reconciliation and building community and love and understanding is our truest nature as human beings. And I think our work is, at the end of the day, as simple as getting back in touch with our truest human nature. And if you think about it that way, it's actually not that hard because we all have the capacity for it.
Thank you so much for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio today, Kazu. It's an honor to be here doing this work with you.
Thank you for having me.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest, Kazuhaga, and to my co-host, Rivera Sun. Our theme song, Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, is performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thanks to my co-host, Sherry Mitchell, whom you can follow on her Sacred Instructions Facebook page. You can find that link on our show notes on Podomatic. Love and Revolution Radio is a weekly radio program, and we're seeing an increasing number of stations pick up the podcast link and broadcast it over the air. So if you'd like your local radio station to be one of them, give them a jingle on the old-fashioned telephone or send them an email about it. It's real easy to do, and you can help us do it. You can reach us with any questions, comments, or insights you might have via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Sherry Mitchell. This week, Kazuhaga gave us an incredible opportunity to consider how we as individuals alone and within the structures that we engage, can become a force for change. One of the areas for us to consider is how we bridge the divide between ourselves and the other, by trying to understand how the other came to be in the place where they are, and how that journey has impacted their ability to show up in the moments where you meet. So I ask you to consider, listeners, how you might reach out with your heart, hands, or minds to find understanding with someone on the other side of an issue that you're engaged in by the time we talk to you next week.
What if you knew that your actions could turn back?